My topic is really loop quantum gravity. This is a short talk, but you can find more details of the topic that are covered here in the Raman Institute conference I gave just last month. And there's also a short review which appeared a couple of years ago. Because I had given this talk in the Raman Institute, I had actually prepared a completely different talk which had to do with interface of quantum information and quantum gravity. But rightly, the organizers told me that for this day, the theme is basically beyond QFT. And so I switched, and I'm giving you this talk about loop quantum gravity. So I'm divided into three parts. First is key distinguishing features, because the last couple of days, the focus was much more on quantum field theory. Related approaches, so what are the distinguishing features here? The second is a shorter part, which has to do with the illustrative applications in cosmology and summary in Outlook. This is a work that is really done by many, many years. Loop quantum gravity is a mature subject, more than 35 years old, and so there are really tens of thousands of papers by hundreds of researchers. So of course, it's not possible to give you a comprehensive review of the various things that are happening. And that is why the title, that it is only glimpses. And in particular, there are many topics that I cannot cover, in particularly black holes and spin forms. But there is a session on black holes, and there's Bianca who will hopefully speak something about spin forms. But my apologies in advance for topics I'm not able to cover. Now, the very first topic, which has to do with the key distinguishing features of loop quantum gravity, is a little bit of a transition from the usual quantum field theory. And so please forgive me, that is going to be a little bit technical. I'll try to be slower. And then after that, it's not so technical. I mean, conceptually, there's a big jump. And I would like to explain it with a few details. So the first distinguishing feature is really the emergent space-time geometry. So in the last couple of days, I mean, one had either a given space-time geometry or the space-time geometry or metric was a basic variable over which one integrated. Here we don't have that. It's a background independent theory of connections. So basically, to begin with, there is no metric with any signature. We just have a background independent theory of connections. Now I could start with the action, which is what would be perhaps more compatible with what was done last couple of days. But the emphasis here in my talk is going to be the Hamiltonian formulation as opposed to the path integrals or spin forms. And so I would like to start with the Hamiltonian formulation. And therefore, the phase space for this background independent theory. So you just have three manifold. It's in four space-time dimensions, ultimately. Therefore, you just are given a three-dimensional manifold. And on that, what you have is SU2 valued pairs. So there's a connection. This is like Young-Mills connections, taking values in SU2. And its conjugate electric field, and that is on a three-manifold. There is no background metrics, and therefore the dynamics is determined by the constraints. And the simplest functions that you can write down, which do not require a background structure, any background field, which can be expressed completely in terms of the dynamical variables, A and E, that we have, are the following. The first one is at most linear E and linear in A, because of this gauge covariant derivative as a term which is proportional to A. And then the next one is at most linear in E, and here I got F, and therefore this is quadratic in A. And the next term that you can write down is quadratic in E, the worst dependence is quadratic in E and quadratic in A. So this really is a low-order polynomial functions you can write down. And it literally is true that if you just take some students and put them in a room and say, write down the only meaningful functions which are gauge covariant, then this is what they would come up with without reference to any background structures. And surprisingly, so if you take these as the constraints on this phase space, then they automatically satisfy a first-class system where the phase space is, these are canonically conjugate as in a gauge theory. So to begin with, we just have these variables, we just have connections. Now, there is no background metric, and therefore, as I said, dynamics is really governed by constraint. So the Hamiltonian is a linear combination of the constraints. So here you have got a free index, internal free index. So you get a smearing function, which has an internal index up here. Here you have got a vector index, which is free. Therefore, you've got a vector field up here, and this curly V is just this constraint. Similarly, curly G is a Gauss constraint, which is just this. And similarly, curly S for scalar constraint, because there's no free index, and therefore I got here a function, technically it's a density weighted object. And as in any gauge theory, the first term just generates internal gauge rotations. That is what Gauss constraint always does. So we don't need a metric for that, it's a fact. The second term always generates diffeomorphisms, and these diffeomorphisms are diffeomorphisms in the bundle that is defined by the connection up here. So in particular, there are lifts of the diffeomorphism on the base space taken to the bundle. And the main problem has been this term, which is of course the term which ultimately will generate the non-trivial dynamics, and what about it? And it did not have a geometrical interpretation until recently, when it was realized that, in fact, what it does is to generate a gauge the second term generates gauge covariantly derivatives, and the third term actually is just a generalization of these gauge covariant derivatives. So again, the second term is a gauge covariant lead derivative along on the spatial manifold, and the third term is a generalization of it. And that generalization is just written out here. Basically, it's like the lead derivative, except that in lead derivative, this can be any derivative operator, whereas here, it is a derivative operator determined by the connection up here that you have, the dynamical variable. So this lead derivative is not the property just of the manifold, but depends also on the choice of connection. But then the statement is that, the change in A under this constraint is just given by this generalized lead derivative, and the change in E is also given by generalized lead derivative, where this is a triplet of vector fields, or if you like, Lie algebra valued vector field on the three manifold, and that is just obtained by taking this scalar function that we have got, our density weighted object, and multiplied it by E. E is also density weighted, they are opposite density weights, and therefore this really is a vector field which takes values in Lie algebra. So the generalization of the Lie derivative is just the following. Lie derivatives are defined on the manifold. Generalized Lie derivatives require an additional structure, and that additional structure is really a connection up here, a gauge connection, and they are generated by Lie algebra valued vector fields. So this is a big difference up here. And in the final picture, this turns out to be precisely the time evolution of in general relativity. So if you like, the time evolution is really transmuted to space evolution in the sense of generalized Lie derivatives along the space-like vector, triplets of space-like vector fields. So here is a definition of the generalized Lie derivative. So of course, it's antisymmetric in these two vector fields. So it provides us with a graded Lie algebra. The reason why it is graded is because if you give me a vector field, normally if you give me a vector field, the Lie derivative with respect to another vector field is again a vector field. But here we're taking the lead derivative with respect to something which is already Lie algebra valued. It already has a I index up here. And therefore, this right-hand side has two indices, ij. So if you give me two vector fields with just one Lie algebra valued index, the right-hand side is a vector field, but it has two Lie algebra, the two indices in the Lie algebra. And the claim is that the corresponding, so this, one can check the Bianchi identity satisfied, therefore this is a graded Lie algebra. And the claim is really that the corresponding infinite dimensional graded Lie group, if you can define it, and this is a very nice problem for mathematicians, then that embodies the entire content of general relativity dynamics. I'm just stating this, I'm going to explain this in a minute. So understanding this structure is a fascinating open problem in mathematics. So far I just talked about this theory of connection, you know, the manifold and theory of connections and so on. And you say, okay, that's all fine. You've got a theory. Is diffeomorphism covariant and gauge invariant? But so what? Right? What does it have to do with gravity? What does it have to do with general relativity? So the point is that general relativity in both signatures, plus minus the Lorentzian signature as well as the Euclidean signature, emerges as two real sections of this gauge theory phase space. There is a precise dictionary from these pairs into the metric variables. So normally, in the Hamiltonian framework, it's formulated in terms of metric, and the canonical coordinate is a three metric, and its conjugate momentum is essentially an extension curvature, determines the time derivative of the three metric, which I have written down here as P. So these are three metric, and this is the canonically conjugate momentum. And here is the signature, epsilon is equal to 1, corresponds to Euclidean signature, and epsilon equal to minus 1 corresponds to the Lorentzian signature. And now we got this constraints to begin with, which I had written down here, which knew nothing about the background metric. These are the simplest gauge covariant and diffeomorphism covariant functions that you can write down. And the statement is that, that these are completely equivalent to the standard vector constraint in general relativity and the standard scalar constraint in general relativity. Notice that here the signature matters in this science in standard general relativity, whereas here there's no signature. This is true just on the entire complex phase space, and on the two real sections, you get the right correct signatures. And then what about evolution equations? The evolution equation here were very simple. The canonical transformation generated by this constraint was very simple. It was just generalized gauge covariantly derivative. What this wiggly sign means is that this is equal to this up to the Gauss constraint. Okay, so then the Gauss constraint disappears in the ADM variables, metric variables, and then the statement is that here we got the evolution equation. And you can see that these evolution equations, you don't have to understand the details, but you can see they're much, much more complicated. That this particularly has no obvious geometrical meaning, and whereas previously we had a gauge covariant, generalized gauge covariant lead derivative. And here it's also non-polynomial. You get inverses of metric up here. It depends on the signature. But the right-hand sides up here are complicated, but they are complicated because with a non-polynomial dependence. But this is simply because these are to be regarded as composite fields. In other words, in this dictionary, where we go from here to here, the metric is obtained as a quadratic combination. These E's are basically triads or density-weighted triads. And therefore, this is like the square root of this object up here. And therefore, the metric and the extrinsic curvature are really composite of fields or composite operators. And their expressions in terms of the fundamental ones are really complicated. This is a bit like in what happens in dynology between QCD and nuclear physics. At a structural level, QCD is much simpler than nuclear physics. But of course, phenomenologically, nuclear physics is very, very rich. So similarly here, phenomenologically, the metric description of general relativity is very, very rich, but structurally it's much simpler, as we'll see, as we already saw in the connection variables, because everything is just given by gauge covariant lead derivatives or generalized gauge covariant lead derivatives. Now, therefore, we got this duality between gauge theories and gravity. So one might be tempted to think, oh, this is like string theory. But there are key differences. So it's true that duality exists in both theories, but there are key differences between the ADS-CF correspondence and here. Namely, here, both sides are defined in the bulk. There is no boundary theory. Both the gauge theory and the gravity theory or the metric theory is defined in the bulk. And the duality does not require a negative cosmological constant or supersymmetry or extra dimensions. And the dictionary is complete. In ADS-CFT, we don't have complete dictionaries. And it is exact and is explicit. And also in ADS-CFT, the bulk of the work is a negative cosmological constant. We don't need that. But nonetheless, since the description is so simple in terms of gauge theories, the idea is to take gauge theory seriously and then go over to quantum theory using this gauge theory description, particularly taking ideas from Young-Nilis series, which have to do with things like Wilson loops and such observables, which are not local, but which are physically very interesting. Now, just as a power of connection, power of this just geometrization, you don't have to understand any of these things. Just the statement is that in the matrix variable, if you want to compute the points of bracket between two scalar constraints, it takes more than 10 pages. In Thiemann's book is a very succinct description, and even then he has left over, it requires 10 pages, but even he left out some intermediate state. Here there is a complete derivation of the commutation between the two scalar constraints. And all that is required here is really the definition of the action of the scalar constraint, namely generalized gauge covariantly derivatives, and then just epsilon identities to simplify something, and then just one integration by parts. So the point up here is really that this geometrization really simplifies things enormously, and the right-hand side equals the right-hand side in the ADM variables, which is a Q number, and also, more importantly, is non-polynomial, and furthermore, here it depends on the signature. All that really emerges in both signatures from this. And Varadarajan has promoted the geometric action of the Hamiltonian constraint to quantum theory, the full LQG, non-perturbative, just full LQG, through very careful and elaborate constructions. So now we want to use this gauge theory to go over to quantum theory. And so we want to know that there is a new syntax up here. Now recall that Einstein discovered general relativity in two steps. He first recognized that Kerr space-time metric incorporates gravity, whence the Riemannian geometry is a natural syntax for gravitational physics. And in the second step, he found the correct dynamical equations that determines the metric. Loop quantum gravity uses the same steps, but now in quantum gravity. The Heisenberg algebra generated by the metric and extrinsic curvature in geometrical dynamics is replaced by the algebra of holonomies, that is to say Wilson lines of a connection, and electric fluxes through two surfaces. This does not require any background geometry, background metric to do these integrals. And it's a highly non-trivial result due to these people that this algebra admits a unique background independent representation. The Hilbert space is a space of square integral functions on the quantum configuration space of connections with a regular Borel measure, which is really rigorously defined, and physically interesting operators are well-defined self-adjoint operators or unitary operators on this Hilbert space, and these are rigorous results and there are no hidden infinities. On this Hilbert space, the geometric operators have purely discrete eigenvalues. Thus, the Riemannian geometry is quantized exactly in the same sense that energy and angular momentum are quantized in the hydrogen atom. And this quantum Riemannian geometry is the LQG syntax to formulate and answer physically interesting questions also in quantum gravity. And also for the topics that I'm not covering, namely spin forms and investigation of black holes, quantum black holes. Now, quantum Riemannian geometry. So we got these geometrical observables, which are now self-adjoint operators on this particular Hilbert space, and one can therefore find their eigenvalues. And the point is that these operators have only discrete eigenvalues, and there is the smallest non-zero eigenvalue of the area operator called the area gap, and that plays an important role in dynamics because curvature is defined in terms of holonomies around closed curves, for example, the Wilson curves. And therefore, this is the basis of Planck scale non-locality that was discussed in the first day. Namely, in LQG has its Planck scale non-locality. The black hole entropy calculation tells us what is the value of this area gap that is fixed by this black hole entropy calculations. And there's an analytical formula which reduces to about 5.16 Planck length squared. And the volume operator, so this volume operator is associated with a region of space. And that plays a key role in the definition of the Hamiltonian constraint in the full non-perturbative theory. The basis that diagonalizes the self-adjoint operators is given by spin networks. It's a graph which is decorated, which is labeled by representation of the SU2. And then at the vertices, there are intertwiners which tie up all these representations, the incoming ones with the outgoing ones. And this is a very powerful calculational technique. And they facilitated also the visualization of quantum geometry. The idea is basically that you can think of these nodes as being giving you little chunks of volume, and anytime they intersect a surface, they deposit a quantum of area on that surface. Now, quantum dynamics, the Hamiltonian approach. In the Hamiltonian approach, along Dirac, quantum dynamics is incorporated by solving the quantum constraint equations. Namely, you promote the constraints to operators and impose them on the states and say that the states should be killed by them. Those are the physical states. So first, we have to give physical precise meaning to these constraint operators. And the LQG kinematics provides the necessary tools, and this issue of providing precise mathematical meaning to the constraint operators is still open in the Wheeler-DeWitt theory. In classical general relativity, the structure of the constraint algebra ensures four-dimensional diffeomorphism covariance. In geometry dynamics, the action of the vector constraint has a direct geometrical meaning as a generator of three-dimensional diffeomorphisms, which translates to their Poisson algebra. But the Hamiltonian constraint, there is no such geometrical interpretation. And this changed in connection dynamics up here, and we got the key questions of quantum dynamics has been, is the Poisson algebra of constraints faithfully lifted to quantum theory? And until recently, the answer was not known, but this work of Madhavan has really lifted it and to quantum theory completely. So now let me just go to the next topic, which is a little bit shorter, which is the illustrative example, which is an application. So the illustrative example is to quantum cosmology. In quantum cosmology, it is a study of cosmological sector of quantum gravity using symmetry reduction. In effect, one focuses on few geometrical observables of interest to dynamics of the universe, for example, the matter density, the scale factors, the scalar curvature, and some matter fields that you may have, like the inflaton, and traces out other degrees of freedom. There's no physical matter or no new boundary conditions. Rather, the quantum geometry effects change the Einstein's equations, and a distinguishing feature is that one uses methods from full loop quantum gravity to cosmological models. And this provides us the new syntax. And dynamics here is relational. Namely, one asks the question, how do some observable change with respect to the other? There's no background time, there is no background space metric. And one finds that the quantum geometry creates a brand new repulsive force in the Planck regime, overwhelming the classical attraction, and the Big Bang is replaced by a big bounce. And there's a maximum density, which is rho sup. And this is the analytical formula, and you can see that the area gap appears in the denominator up here. And this has been analyzed in great detail, and all curvature singularities are resolved. Now, there is an unforeseen interplay between ultraviolet and infrared that makes it interesting to apply these ideas to observations. Namely, detailed calculations show that quantum geometry effects that dominate the Planck scale, leading to singularity resolution, dissipate very quickly after the bounce and become negligible already at the offset of inflation, at the onset of inflation, where the curvature is about 10 to the minus 12 Planck length to the minus 2. Nonetheless, they can leave observable signatures in this little interval between the bounce, just immediately after the bounce, two or three e-foldings. There are some differences arise, and they can leave signatures. Now, how can this happen? Well, in loop quantum gravity, the curvature has a universal upper bound because the density has a universal upper bound, and that is achieved at the bounce. Thus, curvature radius is non-zero and provides a length scale, a new length scale. In general relativity, this is just zero because the curvature is infinite. So this is a new length scale. During the pre-inflationary evolution, the perturbation modes whose wavelength is much smaller than this length scale at the bounce are unaffected by curvature. It is like the fact that the Earth is curved, but when I walk here, my steps are much smaller than the radius of curvature, so I don't feel the curvature. So these modes similarly don't feel the curvature. But in fact, if I were to fly, then I would have to take into account this curvature, that the Earth is actually curved. And so similarly, modes whose physical wavelength is much larger than the LQC scale at the bounce, they do feel the curvature, and therefore they are not really left invariant. They're affected, and therefore they are not in the Bunch-Davis vacuum at the onset of inflation, and these effects leave observable signatures, but only for very long wavelength, and therefore in the infrared. So this is the unforeseen interplay between ultraviolet and infrared. Namely, the singularity is resolved, the new scale is created because of ultraviolet behavior, but infrared behavior is really what it pertains. Its imprint is left on the observable cosmological perturbations through this infrared effect. Now, the detailed calculations show that the kinematics and dynamics, they all use the same principles as in full LQG, but to make observational predictions, additional inputs are needed to select states of the background, Friedman, Robertson, Lemaître, Walker, quantum geometry, as well as in the standard inflation. This is true. In the standard inflation, you also need an initial state for perturbations. So similarly, here it is true. In the approach I will discuss, these are provided by certain principles, But I think at the moment, I'm not going to go into the details of that. Now, there is a change in the primordial spectrum as a result of this. Namely, at the longest wavelength, which are the shortest wave numbers, there is a power suppression. So this is a primordial spectrum at the end of inflation. The standard answers used by Planck data is really that the power spectrum is given by an amplitude multiplied by a k upon k star. This is a pivot scale times some ns, the spectral index minus 1. And there is a slight running, namely there's slight tilt, red tilt, in the spectrum because of this factor up here. For small k's, there is a little more power. Now here I'm plotting the ratio of the LQC versus the standard answers, and one finds that there is actually a suppression, and therefore the in LQC, in effect, there is a function here multiplying, which actually is less than 1 in this region and equal to 1 for large k's up here. So the predictions for CMB is that there's a window of opportunity. Overall, standard inflation is in excellent agreement with observations, but there are anomalies. Statistical significance of any one of these anomalies is rather low. But if you take two or more of these anomalies together, that means that we live in a rather exceptional universe. So can we alleviate this analogy, this tension of anomalies? And Planck team itself has emphasized that if any of the anomalies have primordial origin, then the large scale nature would suggest an explanation rooted in fundamental physics. Thus, it is worth exploring any models that might explain anomaly, or even better, multiple anomalies naturally or with a few parameters. And in LQC, two anomalies are naturally alleviated, preserving the success of standard inflation. And this is the power suppression anomaly for L less than 30, where I got a suppression of observations have lower power than the standard Ansatz predicts, and the Lenzing amplitude anomaly, which has to do with the Lenzing, gravitational Lenzing that takes place as the CMB propagates from the surface of last scattering to us. And these are two anomalies, and they are simultaneously resolved without any additional input. Direct observational check also warehouses on the area gap. So this is really observations constraining theory. Namely, what we can make is we have got the area gap coming from black hole entropy, but we can make it a variable in LQs in the loop quantum cosmology analysis of CMB, and we can see what is the most likely value. And one finds that in fact the value that comes from black hole entropy lies within 1 sigma of the standard answer. And the increase in the area gap by a factor of 10, for example, is observationally ruled out at 95% confidence level. So there is an unforeseen synergy and a bridge from observations to fundamental theory. So there's really, I mean, first of all, we started with this really grand theoretical framework. The geometry is emergent, there's only connections and so on. And then one is making contact with these observations. And one is seeing that there is, first of all, observations provide us some consistency as well as actually alleviate some anomalies. And now, so how does this happen? Well, as you know, that the usual cosmological model has 6 parameters. It turns out that with respect to observations, the relative error in 5 parameters is less than 0.40, but in the optical depth 6 parameter is 13.65%. And what happens is precisely this value is changed. So these values, LQC, the universe according to LQC and the Planck data, these 5 values are essentially the same, but this value is changed by about 10%. And therefore, an independent missions would measure this tau accurately, maybe even to 1% accuracy, and therefore, what would we actually be able to see, if in fact this is falsified or this is verified. If it is falsified, then one has to go back to the drawing board and worry about the prescription that we gave for initial conditions. Okay, so here is the summary and outlook. Loop quantum gravity provides a specific syntax for quantum gravity that descends from a background-independent gauge theory. There is no metric. It is a dictionary which makes the metric available. It's just like, there are no fundamental nucleon fields, but it's really the bound states of quarks which give us various nuclei up here. In nuclear physics. So this paves a non-perturbative background independent approach. And in this talk, I sketched the Hamiltonian approach and its application in the early universe. But it illustrates that the approach is sufficiently mature to make contact with observations. And as I emphasized, there is also a huge work in spin forms, and they're also on quantum aspects of black holes. There are many analytical results, and fortunately now numerical calculations are getting mature, and that really is, therefore the synergy is really increased enormously, and the rate of progress has also accelerated. And there's also interface with quantum information, and this is actually what I was going to talk about, namely about some of the quantum information issues, but that was is a separate talk altogether. So LQG is very much an ongoing program. There are many interesting problems remain in all sub-areas. Different groups are working on various open issues. The conceptual, mathematical, and numerical aspects of LQG, as well as applications to astrophysical and cosmological observations and phenomenology. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Abhay, for a very nice talk. I see one question by Miguel up there.
Thanks for a very nice talk. So I wanted to ask, so you explained how the theory in terms of connections is, there's no background metric, so it doesn't say it's background independent, but you formulated it in a background topology. So I wanted to ask, is topology, is it a background loop quantum gravity? Can it fluctuate? Do we some of our topologies or, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so when we started the classical theory, there's a background manifold, and therefore there's no topology. I mean, the topology is fixed and so on. But when you go to the spin networks and so on, you can think of these spin networks abstractly, not living in any manifold. Now, therefore that reference to there are new observables coming into picture. For example, if you may have not invariants and different topologies, there will be different kinds of holonomies might be non-trivial, even if the curvature is zero and so on and so forth. But we're not really summed over all topologies so far. We're not really looked at that problem at all, because at a fundamental level, there are just these two complexes and spin networks, and not so much the worry about, the topology of the underlying manifold, because the emergence of the topology of the underlying manifold has not been studied in great detail. Not been studied very much at all.
But is there an expectation that there would be when you get like a some topology emergence, are there expectations that can fluctuate or?
As a general rule, the one big limitation of LQG really has been making contact with low energy physics, or that's a really problem. What we have is basically the propagator. That's the only thing that has been done, and it has all the correct properties and so on and so forth. Final propagator that has correct properties. But more than that, really, making connections with low energy physics, in which you will have some more topologies in these pictures, that has not been done.
Thank you.
There was another question by Neil, and I see there's more questions, but I remind you that we have an open discussion where Abhay is also there later. Later today, so please, Neil.
Okay, yeah, thank you for the very nice talk. One of the things you would hope for in a good theory of quantum gravity would be a measure on the space of possible four geometries. And when you start talking about inflation, this is, of course, the Achilles heel of inflation, that there is no known measure, and therefore one cannot really judge whether an inflationary model is successful or not at making the universe flatter and more smooth. Somehow in your talk, you didn't deal with this issue.
No. In the cosmological sector, we have a detailed paper about this measure issue and compared with yours and Gibbon's paper and so on and so forth, where the usual thing is that you cannot really specify the measure at the singular. Because of gauge problems, which we can discuss in great detail later, but because of gauge problems, you really have to give a surface on which at which you want to evaluate the measure, if you like. Look at the initial data and look at the measure of that. We can discuss this in great detail.
I'm talking about the measure on four geometries.
Yeah, this will be the measure on four geometries.
Not initial
surface. I agree. What I'm saying is that to give... Okay. There's a big controversy in the literature about how, if in fact, inflation is likely or is not likely. The problem is really about this measure not being well defined. And the problem has to do with gauge that we have sort of spelled out very clearly in this paper. It has to do with the fact that the scale factor is not gauge invariant, because, you know, scale factor doesn't mean anything. I need a reference metric to talk about a scale factor. Time-dependent scale factor I'm talking about. Now, if you resolve this ambiguity by going at late times, as you did, then the probability of inflation is low. And then Linde and other people were doing it kind of, quote-unquote, in the Planck regime, which is not completely well-defined, yeah, and so on, and they are finding that probability is very high. Now, however, what when loop quantum gravity, this problem of this, what I call gauge ambiguity, can be resolved by specifying, by going to the bounds, because there is a preferred surface. It's not anything. And I can ask in a very clean gauge invariant manner what the probability of inflation is in a given potentials, for example. And we find that the probability of inflation is very high if you are given a potential, but that has to be given. So this is a very detailed discussion in a paper about, you know, maybe,
To say, I will be presenting a different point of view on Friday.
Yeah, so we thought about it quite a bit, and it is four geometries, yes, but the problem comes up because of this gauge problem. And therefore, in order to mathematically give the probabilities, evaluate them, you seem to require additional structure.
But I'm afraid, in light of time, we have to keep going.
No problem.
I'm very sorry. Let's thank Abhay again for the nice talk.